occurring this year on Venezuela with the largest proven oil reserves in the world, and on Iran now with the third largest reserves in the world. So is it your sense that the Trump administration is essentially now becoming not only an empire, but an empire seeking to control world oil supplies?
You know, I think that the two wars, military uses of the military, are not identical. Of course, Iran has long been a target of obviously the Israelis and of the Americans, and sometimes for the same reasons, and sometimes for different reasons, and sometimes for reasons that support each other, and sometimes they don't necessarily support each other. But the source of Iran's power is certainly its fossil fuels and its control of fossil fuels. And if you want to take those fossil fuels, if you're U.S. oil companies, that's a goal.
10 seconds, Antonia.
But also, if you want to deflate Iran's power, going after its fossil fuels is one of the key ways to do that. And that's clearly an agenda that's being advanced by this administration.
Antonia, we're going to do part two of this discussion, put online at democracynow.org. Antonia Yuhas, independent investigative journalist, regular Rolling Stone politics reporter, will continue after the broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, education funding crises push Portland schools, colleges, and universities into hard decisions. A new law expands access to abortion medications in Washington. And in international news, Trump's blind ambition in attacking Iran could spell even worse than dictatorship for the Iranian people. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 10, 2026. I'm Eric Leuschner. The first community college strike in Oregon's history could begin tomorrow if last-minute negotiations don't hammer out a tentative agreement. Unionized faculty and classified staff at Portland Community College voted to authorize a strike last month after what they called an insulting final offer from the college. The college offered a 0.35% cost of living increase for both of the next 2 years. Cost of living adjustments are often indexed to inflation, which is usually between 2 and 3%, which keeps workers' wages from degrading in value over time. There are other issues at stake too, including retroactive pay and the cutting of popular programs. PCC says they need to balance their budget since they're facing rising costs, declining enrollment, and little state or federal funding help. PCC professors and unionized staff plan to walk out of all campuses tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. and will picket the four main campuses until 1:30 p.m. PCC says they will still try to offer classes and student services if possible. Grades for the current school term will be up within 5 days of staff returning, and if the strike lasts past the beginning of spring term at the end of March, students could ask for a refund. Portland Public Schools says they'll cut some administrative positions in the face of a major budget shortfall. But the teachers' union, the Portland Association of Teachers, say they haven't gotten a clear picture of the district's finances and it might not be enough. The state's largest school district is facing a $50 million budget hole and a $14 million budget gap this year. District leaders plan to cut 13 administrator roles, saving over $2 million. Administrators will be asked to reapply for fewer roles next year, and some administrators will take a week of furlough. Unionized teachers were asked to take 2 furlough days or see 100 teachers laid off, but that ask was recently doubled. 4 days, no pay, or 200 teachers would be laid off. Rachel Gumpert with the Portland Association of Teachers said in a statement, quote, "Our trust in PPS's ability to navigate their financial realities has been broken, and our good faith feels taken advantage of. We continue to experience a lack of respect, unsafe working environments, and unsustainable workloads," end quote. The union says they will do their own analysis of the district's finances and propose an alternative budget to address the budget crisis. They also say Governor Kotek should consider calling a special legislative session on education to address the large-scale education funding issues on display across the state. Portland State University plans to cut or reduce 19 departments, President Ann Cudd says. PSU will start a process called retrenchment, which formally downsizes the university in a moment of financial crisis. Everything from certificates to doctorate offerings could be impacted. The university studies department could be cut completely. Departments like history, philosophy, economics, politics, and criminal justice are in the conversation to see cuts. It's a big deal for faculty and students. Portland State has the third highest enrollment of all Oregon colleges, but by the end of next school year, the university will need to close a $35 million deficit. PSU isn't alone in their budget crisis. Oregon State didn't reach its enrollment projections, and Southern Oregon University received a $15 million bailout from the state to cover its payroll for the next year. A new law will enhance access to Washington State's existing abortion medication stockpile, removing requirements to sell the medication at cost and allowing for faster distribution. Advocates say the law ensures the 30,000-plus doses of mifepristone and misoprostol remain accessible, protecting productive health services amid ongoing federal uncertainty. Isabel Charlet reports.
Advocates for reproductive care are celebrating a new law that will increase access to medication abortions for Washingtonians. In 2023, the state spent about $1.2 million on a 3-year supply of mifepristone and misoprostol, 2 medications commonly used for abortion and miscarriage care, as a safeguard against legal threats to access. But much of the medication still remains undistributed and is set to expire. Family doctor Zoe Taylor says the new law removes barriers so the medication can be sold for cheaper or donated more easily. She says this will be a big help because the medication can cost patients hundreds of dollars.
There are people every day who can't afford this medication who need it in this country, and there are providers who are trying to stay in the black but trying to let people pay what they can. And so if we can donate it to those providers too, I mean, this is just such a no-brainer.
Initial rules required the state to sell the medication at list price plus a $5 fee, which was higher than provider rates, hindering distribution. Republican lawmakers argued against the new law, saying the fact that the stockpile of medication is about to expire shows the initial purchase was unnecessary. With Washington seeing more patients from other states seeking reproductive care, Taylor says the Department of Health should sell or donate the medications to mail-order pharmacies as well as clinics. She says this would ease access for both patients and providers.
The more of that we can do by telemedicine or through the mail, the less we make people travel, the less we make people take off work, the less they have to figure out childcare.
She adds more telemedicine means more appointments stay available for Washingtonians who need in-person care. Taylor emphasizes that using medication for early pregnancy loss and termination is safe and common in the first trimester. Medication abortion accounts for nearly 70% of abortions in Washington and costs an average of $600. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Even though they support the arts themselves, many Portlanders hate the city's arts tax. They feel it was poorly designed and regressive, and that bureaucracy has limited its appropriate use. Now, some complaints are coming from the very organizations meant to benefit from the tax. A group of 50 Portland arts organizations sent a letter to Portland elected officials asking to use unspent art tax money to help nonprofits that have seen a decline in city funding in recent years. They write, quote, "These funds should serve as a bridge towards a renewed era of increased public investment in Portland's vibrant arts and culture community and creative economy." End quote. The request comes after the city reported some $8.5 million in unallocated arts tax monies, all while arts organizations that should receive arts tax funding saw a 44% dip in city financing. The Arts Education and Access Tax, commonly known as the Arts Tax, is an annual $35 tax on any Portlander who earns over $1,000 yearly. It generates roughly $12 million each year. The majority of funding derived goes towards public school art programs, with the rest going to administrative costs and towards grants for arts nonprofits that offer arts education. Meanwhile, new rules adopted by the city's Office of Arts and Culture have shifted the fund to prioritize nonprofits with larger budgets, marginalizing other nonprofits that relied on grant support. Council President Jamie Dunphy has called to reform the city's arts tax since entering office. Dunphy wants to restore the 44% cuts in arts organization funding, which would amount to $1.5 million annually. He also wants the city to focus on overhauling the tax to ensure it is equitably distributed and fairly collected. Dunphy said he plans to introduce an ordinance by April that would send $1.5 million back to arts nonprofits. President Trump vows to block all bills until Congress passes a strict voter ID act. The FBI receives subpoenaed election documents from Arizona, and North Carolina's governor pleads for lawmakers to pass a critical needs budget after 2 years without a state spending blueprint. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm here to do a great job for the country, but we don't have a country if we're going to have elections that are so corrupt and so dishonest like we've witnessed.
President Donald Trump says he won't sign any bills until Congress passes the Save America Act, which restricts ballot access by requiring people to present proof of citizenship in person to vote or register. Senate Democrats are blocking it, motivating some Trump allies to back ending the filibuster. Also stalled a confirmation for Mark Wayne Mullen as the next Homeland Security Secretary and funding for DHS after a month-long shutdown. Maricopa County, Arizona election officials complied with a subpoena and turned over voting records from the 2020 election to the FBI. They say they're confused by demands for materials relating to an Arizona State Senate audit made public years ago. A few months ago, the Bureau raided an Atlanta election center as part of Trump's effort to investigate consistently debunked claims of election fraud. In what could spread to other red states, a new South Dakota law will soon allow voters to challenge the citizenship of other voters. Immigrant rights advocates say it adds to an atmosphere of xenophobia and racial profiling, but Deputy Secretary of State Tom Diedrich says it protects the integrity of elections and the challenge process is fair and thorough.
This is not going to be something where somebody can just say, oh, I don't think you're a U.S. citizen. That doesn't work that way. It would take something on the order of, I know this person has a green card because they work for me and they're not a U.S. citizen.
The law will be in effect for the midterms. A Trump executive order pressing farmers to use the herbicide glyphosate faces pushback from environmental scientists. Trump says more use of Bayer's product Roundup would protect the food supply and is a matter of national security. Danny Replogool with Food and Water Watch says the order abuses the use of the Defense Production Act, which is only for a true national emergency.
This action to increase production of a pesticide already doing incredible harm to public health and our environment, it's absurd. At any time, there is an extremely large proportion of American crop fields already covered in it.
The EPA says there's no direct evidence the chemical is carcinogenic, but Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has enraged followers by supporting it. Congress and nine states, most recently Iowa, have considered shielding Bayer from cancer lawsuits. Roundup is routinely sprayed on Iowa crops and shows up in the state's water. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein is making a plea to state lawmakers to pass a, quote, critical needs budget. It's been 2.5 years since the state passed a new spending blueprint, and Stein says funding levels have left the state with non-competitive salaries. Statehouse Republicans disagree on new tax cut proposals, debating whether they'll cause a budget deficit, but Stein says lawmakers have to get the job done.
Together we can lead our state and stop the bleeding. Let's give North Carolinians the stability they deserve and pass this critical needs budget that makes essential investments.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report interview on the Pride in Numbers survey of Two-Spirit and LGBTQ plus Oregonians. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and an overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 53. Today in history, it's Harriet Tubman Day. The day recognizes the significant work of the abolitionist and worker on the Underground Railroad. Tubman helped to free over 70 people, leading them to the northern free states and Canada. The quote of the day is from Tubman, who said, quote, "I had reasoned this out in my mind. There was one of two things I had a right to, liberty or death. If I could not have one, I would have the other." A second bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security passed the U.S. House, and Arizona Representative Adelita Grijalva tried to add safeguards for tribal members. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A second funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security narrowly passed the U.S. House. Arizona Congresswoman Adelita Grijalva sought to create a safeguard for tribes getting caught up in immigration crackdowns. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Grijalva has been regularly meeting with tribal leaders from across southern Arizona, like the Pasquayaki, Fauna Otham, and Gila River. She says they're all telling her the same thing.
DHS must consult with tribes. They're not doing it now. This administration doesn't honor sovereignty.
Grijalva proposed an amendment to the funding bill that would have required ICE to consult with tribes before conducting immigration enforcement on their land, but the effort failed.
They're all concerned with the presence of ICE and how they are profiling their members because, you know, they might look like working people who have darker skin.
Meanwhile, Kristi Noem has been ousted by President Trump as DHS director. He named Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, who is Cherokee, as her replacement.
Removing Noem doesn't root out the lawlessness at ICE. Maybe leadership style might be different, but the end goal is still the same.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Ketchikan, Alaska-based artist Savannah Lucornu has been selected as this year's poster artist for the Alaska Folk Festival in Juneau. The annual spring event seeks art submissions from Alaska creatives for festival merchandise. KRBD's Hunter Morrison sat down with the artist to discuss how the opportunity will help expand representation of Indigenous artists throughout Alaska.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, sort of what inspires your work as an artist?
I'm an Indigenous artist. I'm part of three different tribes. I'm Tsim Shan, Haida, and Nez Perce. So a lot of my inspiration comes from the art styles of my tribes, as well as my family, surroundings, environment, friends, that kind of thing. So,
and can you tell me a little bit more about like what mediums of art that you sort of specialize in?
Yeah, so mainly I draw and I paint. I do a lot of traditional drawing, but I also do digital drawing as well, too. So working with Procreate on my iPad. And then I also do painting, mainly acrylic, but I have, like, done watercolor here and there.
Okay, I see. And, you know, you were selected as this year's poster artist for the Alaska Folk Festival. You know, I guess, do you have a design yet for that poster, or do you have, like, ideas of what that design might look like?
I don't know how secret they are with it. I will say, like, my inspirations were some of my favorite musicians in Alaska, as well as the Northern Lights.
And, you know, I guess how will this opportunity sort of expand not only your work as an artist, but, like, sort of expand the celebration of Indigenous people and Indigenous art?
What I'm hoping for with being the artist for this year's Folk Fest is that my art is starting, it gets started to seen more, like, widely throughout Alaska, I suppose. I will say it's not my most obviously Indigenous design. I will say all of my art inherently becomes Indigenous because I am Indigenous, but at the same time, like, it's not, there's no form line in it, there's no traditional Native art in it for this design, but I still hope that that means that people, like, look into, like, even my own art and see more of what I do, and that people just explore more of it.
That was Hunter Morrison speaking with Ketchikan artist Savannah Lucornu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative is seeking public comment now through March 19th on trade agreements covering critical minerals like nickel, cobalt, and lithium used in electronics. Advocates are pressing for policies that set standards for the treatment of workers and the environment. Suzanne Potter has more.
The feds are seeking public comment from now through next Thursday on a proposed trade deal to secure critical minerals like cobalt, nickel, and lithium, which are used in cars, phones, and other electronics. The Office of the United States Trade Representative is looking to strike a deal with multiple other countries to boost production and secure supply chains. Arthur Stamoulis with the nonprofit Trade Justice Education Fund wants the Trump administration to make sure U.S. tax dollars don't contribute to child labor or toxic pollution in the mines.
They need to have strong binding standards on labor rights, the environment, indigenous rights, and community consent throughout the supply chain, and we need to ensure that those standards are backed up by swift and certain enforcement mechanisms that include meaningful facility-specific penalties for violations.
The Trump administration is considering deals that would establish a price floor. The idea is to reduce U.S. reliance on China, which currently mines 70% of the world's rare earth minerals and controls almost all mineral processing. Advocates want a deal that sets basic standards to be met before minerals are imported. State data show that mining supports more than 15,000 jobs in Nevada, concentrated in Eureka, Lander, and Elko counties. Stamoulis says people should speak up now because the decisions being made this year could impact how mining operations around the world are shaped for decades.
The details really matter. Depending on how they're written, these trade deals could help countries meet shared climate, job creation, sustainable development goals, or they can end up accelerating really exploitative models of resource extraction that are harmful to workers, communities, and the environment.
Last month, the administration rolled out a $12 billion initiative called Project Vault that would stockpile critical minerals. People can submit their public comment directly on federalregister.gov or sign a petition from the Trade Justice Education Fund at criticalmineralsjustice.org. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
As part of the Make America Healthy Again movement, the Trump administration said it planned to ban synthetic food dyes, including those used in cereal eaten by children. But it's since backfired, with Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announcing that labeling requirements would be loosened. Some experts say the move could allow companies to mislead consumers, or at the very least, cause confusion. Ross Brown has more.
From hyperactivity to cancer, food dyes are known to cause health problems, and the Trump administration's reversal to ban them could complicate the issue. After taking the reins of the Food and Drug Administration, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. promised to remove artificial dyes from the U.S. food supply. But a proposal for an outright ban has turned into a voluntary agreement, with food manufacturers now asked to remove six synthetic petroleum-based food dyes. Thomas Galligan with the Center for Science and the Public Interest notes the additives can cause acute behavioral problems in children.
They can become aggressive, they can have impacts on their sleep, and these types of effects when children are being exposed over and over again can add up and impact children's academic and social success.
Galligan says once a child stops consuming foods containing dyes, many symptoms go away, including behavioral problems. Kennedy has defended the move toward the voluntary agreement as progress that should encourage food companies to adopt safer, naturally derived alternatives. Unlike in the U.S., petroleum-based food dyes are strictly regulated in the European Union, which has caused food manufacturers to stop using them rather than provide a warning label. Galligan says marketing, not nutritional value, is why they're still on the shelves of American grocery stores.
They're just used to help companies sell their product. And so when we have this clear risk and no real benefit for consumers, there's really no reason for the FDA letting companies use these with no restrictions and no regulations to actually protect kids.
In 2023, California became the first state to ban four specific food additives, including red dye number 3. West Virginia also has banned some synthetic dyes, and Texas passed a law to require warning labels. Galligan says states, not the federal government, could ultimately be more influential players.
I am optimistic that with the support of states, we can really pressure the FDA into enacting real reform, despite the historical failures for the FDA to do so.
Target, which has seen its market value drop 65% since late 2021, recently said that by the end of May, it would only carry cereals without certified synthetic colors. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
We now go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. Gertov says President Trump's decision to attack Iran reflects poor judgment, blind ambition, and strategic blunders. The justifications for attacking Iran avoid mention of any imminent threat. He says what comes after Khomeini may be worse than his dictatorship ever was. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. As the invasion of Iran grinds on and its boundaries expand, the House and Senate have rejected resolutions that would bring the savagery to a halt. I have to ask, what will it take to finally break the back of the Trump regime's war madness? Consider how Trump has conducted this latest war. He has violated his own prescriptions for avoiding U.S. involvement abroad. No regime change, no new wars. He is conducting an aggressive war to overthrow the government of Iran, in gross violation of international and domestic law. He has ignored Congress, public opinion, and probably his own military leaders in deciding on war, giving in instead to Israel's pressure for regime change in Iran. He has largely been a disappearing act as national leader, relying on social media rather than the Oval Office to provide limited information. He has delivered surprise gifts to Moscow and Beijing, feeding their propaganda outlets that have denounced U.S. lawlessness in defiance of the U.N. Charter, and forcing Russia to come to Iran's aid with intelligence on U.S. targets. He has presided over an ever-expanding operation that has turned a military action into a full-fledged war, deepening divisions with key allies in Europe, exposing partners in the Middle East to Iranian retaliation, enabling Israeli expansion into Lebanon, and possibly setting the stage for a U.S. ground invasion of Iran. He has shown ignorance of Iran's actual situation, giving Iran's people false hopes that they might seize power, and setting the stage for another dictator. Perhaps worst of all, the administration has offered no clear explanation of why war is in the U.S. national interest, why Iran constitutes an imminent threat to the United States, and why ongoing negotiations with Iran were abandoned and are rejected now in favor of unconditional surrender. Let's discuss the last two points, the post-Khomeini situation in Iran and the lack of a war strategy. Iran without the Ayatollah is surely a good thing for the country's people and for neighboring countries. But nothing good can come of an assassination and all-out assault by a U.S. regime that disregards human rights and the rule of law, joined, moreover, by a partner, Israel, that has committed genocide in Gaza. Trump is proving that point every day with comments that show this president doesn't have any idea of the forces that shape Iran's post-Khomeini future. Iranians who oppose dictatorship are far from united in their conception of the country's political and economic future. Trump was told in an intelligence report dated before he ordered attacks on Iran that the fragmented opposition forces were unlikely to topple the regime, no matter how much force the U.S. brought to bear. Trump's preferred successors to Khomeini have been killed in U.S. attacks, according to the president. Maybe he should have thought twice about bombing on such an immense scale. That leaves the field to another dictator, most likely Khomeini's son. But Trump has declared the son unacceptable, as though Trump is already Iran's viceroy. Trump insists that he must approve the successor, just as he approved Venezuela's new president. All this speaks to America's new imperialism, yet it also displays the facile handling of regime change. For just as Venezuela's new leadership is turning out not to be to Trump's liking, so is another Khomeini in charge in Iran likely to thwart Trump's designs. Worse still, the U.S. invasion may result in even greater repression in Iran than was true before it. As for the reasons behind the U.S. attacks on Iran, the White House and the Secretary of State have given several, none of which can be construed as threatening U.S. security. These are Iran's support of terrorism, Iran's nuclear ambitions, Iran as a global threat, Iran's malign activities, Iran's interference with international commerce, collective self-defense with Israel. Trump's war policy is a strategic failure that centers on use of the Venezuela intervention as a model, but extends to unanticipated events. The model is bankrupt. Unlike Venezuela, war on Iran has not been a quick victory. It has failed to achieve regime change, but may well have facilitated the entrenchment of the Iranian theocratic state. It has expanded the war far beyond Iran to include nearly all of the Middle East, as well as a number of European countries. And Trump is trying to sign up Kurdish and other anti-regime armed groups to fight Iran's forces with U.S. air support, as a substitute for putting U.S. boots on the ground. Moreover, Trump's war has caused considerable and avoidable loss of life, and it has significantly affected international commerce, the flow and pricing of oil, freedom of shipping, and the global supply chain. This multifaceted strategic error will reverberate for years to come. Yet even though the war on Iran is far from over, Trump's aggressiveness is not over. He is publicly talking about another adventure in regime change in Cuba. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 10, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and G. Iguanita. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting